Hello, listeners. Yamina here. Welcome to the Dr. GPCR podcast. If you're watching or listening to the podcast on YouTube, you might be wondering, what am I doing in front of the camera? Well, the podcast, Dr. GPCR podcast, started 4 years ago, and I thought it was time for us to do something differently. Therefore, from now on, the introductions and outros of the podcast will be recorded with the camera on. Before we dive into this episode, I have a few announcements to make. First, I'd like to talk to you about the Dr. GPCR University that we launched in February of 2024. The goal is to provide courses and contents on all aspects of GPCR research to support you, our community. We kicked off the first course of the university by partnering with Dr. Terry Kanakian, who taught a class about applying pharmacology to drug discovery. The class was a great success. Mark your calendars for May 9th, as we are partnering with Dr. Sam Hoare, who will be building on the concepts taught by Dr. Kanakian and will be showing you how to analyze your data. The course is split up into four modules. The first module will be about analyzing concentration curve response data. The second one will be about analyzing agonist pharmacology data. The third one about antagonist pharmacology data. And the last one will be focusing on new dimensions of activity, including allosterism and kinetics. Learn how to handle allosteric modulator data, how to best analyze it and quantify activity in support of medicinal chemistry and target research. Please note that we are very excited to be offering 5 complimentary individual spots to anyone who'd like to join the course and lives in a developing country. This will be on a first come and first serve basis. And if you'd like to join Dr. Hoare's workshop on any of our next classes, we'll make a Google form available to you. I also want to take a moment to highlight that if you are in a developing country and you would like to access all the content in the ecosystem by getting a Dr. GPCR ecosystem premium plan, we do offer a 90% discount on this plan. If you'd like to take advantage of this offer, or if you are facing financial hardship and even with a 90% discount, you are unable to join us, we invite you to email us at hello@drgpcr.com. We are here to help. The second announcement I'd like to make is about the Endocrine and Metabolic GPCRs meeting. What are you doing April 22nd and 23rd? Join me and our GPCR colleagues for the inaugural edition of the Endocrine Metabolic GPCRs meeting taking place in the UK. This event will bring together scientists from both academia and industry to exchange data, technologies, and ideas in the field on GPC endocrine metabolic GPCRs. This meeting is organized by Bioscientifica and endorsed by the Society for Endocrinology. I'd like to say a special thank you to Professors Aileen Hanyalolu, Davide Calibero, Dr. Caroline Gorvin, Dr. Alejandra Tomas, and Professor Peter McCormick for putting together the scientific program of this very exciting meeting. The third announcement I'd like to make is for you to mark your calendar for this year's Dr. GPCR Symposia. This year, we're holding 3 events for which we have planned talks, poster presentations, and panel discussion. Anyone at any level working on GPCRs or related proteins is welcome to give a talk as we aim to democratize our events. If you have a story that you'd like to share in the form of a poster presentation, you're also welcome to join us. It doesn't have to be a full story. It doesn't have to be a full poster. Just bring in a couple of slides that you can use as a visual aid to discuss your project with your peers and colleagues. March 15th, this year was when we held the first Dr. GPCR symposium, and we talked about GPCR activation and signaling. It was a great success. We've had almost 100 people join us for the entire length of the conversations that we had and the talks that were presented. The next symposium, however, will be on June 7th and will be focusing on structural insights into GPCR activation. And then on October 11th, we'll dive deeply into GPCRs as therapeutic targets. If you'd like to join us, if you'd like to give a talk or present a poster at our event, please email us at hello@drgpcr.com. If you want to join us to these events are free. You just have to become a Dr. GPCR ecosystem free site member, and you'll be able to get access to the link to join the talks. And now let's dive into this episode. Hello, everyone. This is Yamina from Dr. GPCR. And today, or this evening, or this morning, depending on where you are, I'm delighted to have with me Dr. Arthur Christopoulos from Monash University. Arthur, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Yamina, and it's a pleasure to be here. Been too long between drinks, as I say.
Very excited to talk to you today. So let's start at the beginning. Although I don't think you need to tell us who you are and what you do, but how about we start with that?
I think it is worth reiterating because a lot of people sort of know me for my research. But I practiced and trained as a pharmacist for at least 6 years while I did my PhD in pharmacology part time. I graduated from the place called the Victorian College of Pharmacy, which is 143 years old, and now it's actually the Faculty of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences of Monash University. So I ended up back where I started from. I trained in neuropharmacology with a guy called Fred Mitchelson, and I think that's a name that the field really needs to know because he doesn't get the credit he deserves. He was an amazing mentor, and he got me into both muscarinic receptors, and he tricked me into allosteric modulation, and we can talk about that at a later stage. After that, I did my postdoc in Minnesota for a couple of years. I was in the Department of Psychiatry with Issam El-Fakahani, who's best known probably for a lot of his work on muscarinic receptor regulation, but I was focusing more on Alzheimer's and nitric oxide and whatever. The typical postdoc thing, you know, you go away to learn something different for what you did in your PhD, but I'm atypical because I ended up back where I started from. And then in around the turn of the millennium in 1999, I came back for my postdoc and I started my lab first at the University of Melbourne in the Department of Pharmacology. That's where I met Patrick Sexton, and we merged our groups and we've been collaborating ever since. In 2006, I was actually recruited from Melbourne to Monash University, but that was in the medical faculty, the Department of Pharmacology, and that's where Roger Summers already was. So the three of us, Patrick, Roger, and I merged our labs into a super lab, and that's the model we've been using ever since. And the key thing that happened then is my predecessor, Bill Charman, who became Dean of the Faculty of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences, an amazing, amazing guy in 07. He basically tricked us to going, well, you're already at Monash in medicine, but you actually should be better here in pharmacy because we need a lot of strength in biology because we've got a lot of strength in chemistry and formulation. It's a very unique setup what they had over there at the Monash Institute of Pharmaceutical Sciences. So you got the whole gang of us, me, Roger, and Patrick, all the rabs or whatever, got to move to pharmacy from medicine in 09. And I've been there ever since. We created essentially, it's like a department, but it's a theme of drug discovery biology. It's huge now. And in the last 5 years, I've been the dean. So I ended up back where I started from.
Wow. That's quite a trajectory. Do you always, because you mentioned you trained as a pharmacist. Why not something else when you were younger? How come you became a pharmacist at first?
Yeah, good question. So let's get the easy bits out of the way first. You know, in the first 5 or 6 years, everybody, you know, I wanted to be an astronaut, a policeman, an astronomer, you know, something like that. I stuck to astronomy for a while, but I realized I've always liked science. That's the first thing. Second thing was basically it was in high school. Around the age of 16 in particular, it was a pivotal period for me because I realized I liked chemistry and I liked biology more than what I thought I liked in the other things. And I also did work experience in a pharmacy. And I saw already at that time that knowing medicines is really good for being at the interface of chemistry and biology, which were both attracted me. And I had a really good inspirational chemistry teacher in around the same time. And I can say pretty much at the age of 16, I made my mind up that I'm going to become a pharmacist because it's kind of like the best of both worlds. Now, there was an additional cheat to that. The additional cheat is when I finished high school, I actually got the marks. I thought, yeah, to do medicine as well, you know, so I did really well. And then I looked at it. I never thought I would, but I looked at it and I thought, well, medicine takes this long a period of time and pharmacy at the time was less. So I said, I'll do pharmacy as well, just to do less. I've never left. and the third cheat is, and here's one for everybody out there. I also discovered the guitar when I was a teenager, and I really play. I love playing the guitar, and I spent a lot of time playing in bands. And I was at one stage deciding whether I wanted to go to the Victorian College of Pharmacy or the Victorian College of the Arts to study guitar. I chose pharmacy. I failed first year pharmacy and had to repeat because I was playing too much in bands, but it made me. In the end, it all worked out. I can't read or write music, but I can play by ear. And that decision, that juncture was important. And I just traded one work ethic for another. And I don't regret it.
I love it. The guitar I knew because I was talking to Roger Sinha.
Roger,
Yes, of
Roger,
course.
Roger owes me a guitar. I'm
I
still waiting
know.
for a Sinha.
I know. I told him. So initially, when you were supposed to travel to the GPCR retreat last year, I was recording the episode with Roger right around, I think, his birthday, and I think Ryan Kubilka and Michel Bouvier and everybody flew out to San Diego to surprise him. Which he didn't know at the time, he told me afterwards. And then I was talking to him and I said, you make guitars, you have to make one for Arthur. He's coming because he was mentioning this. So.
I've spoken to Roger about this. We were texting each other recently. He's been sending me photos of his latest creations, and I've seen photos of some of my new ones. He knew. I mean, I wasn't well. That's why I couldn't travel last year. I had a hip replacement. But that's why I had to pull the plug on a lot of the meetings and also COVID Dean. But Roger and I were talking about this for ages. But Roger, as we all know, Roger works on ro evolutionary timescales. He's so meticulous and it takes time. So I'm hoping I'll get it one day. I know it's going to be a beautiful instrument, and I'm probably predicting something in the fretboard or the inlay is going to do something with magnesium, but I'm not sure.
Oh, we'll see. I'll be curious to see that. I also wanted to, so I liked how you really pointed out that inflection point where you were playing too much in bands, spending too much time instead of studying, and then failing that first year. I think those inflection points are important. Everybody needs to fail at least once. I did fail a class one time. It was drama for about 30 minutes, and then I had to repeat it, and repeating it was amazing. It was French literature. And the teacher I had was phenomenal the second time. So I don't regret it. I got to read other books and do other things that I would have never done with the first class. But how did you at that time handle the failure?
Well,
Single
not well,
class.
but not unexpected. What the failure taught me was the value of working hard, developing a hard work ethic. So if you look at every successful person on the planet, I don't care what they do, whether they're a painter, whether they're Elon Musk, whether they're Donald Trump, even whatever, the common denominator they all have is they work hard. It's not about the other bits. It's actually, you got to work hard. And especially if you're, say, an intelligent person, and then you're in a room with a whole bunch of other smart people too, it's not that. It's how you apply it and how you buckle down. So if I didn't fail that first year and learn how to study properly, really apply the work ethic on top of what I had already, I wouldn't be here now. And I wouldn't have met, the friends that I'd made, and I would have met the inspirational mentor who was one of our lecturers that became my PhD advisor. None of this. I wouldn't be talking to you if I hadn't failed first year.
Yeah,
So
I can relate to that. Had I not gone through, in my case, through some difficulties from 2019 to 2020 with my work, the Dr. GPCR podcast would have never existed.
You see,
So.
it's it. Everyone needs some sort of kick in the derriere or a slap in the or a bit of cold water to.
Yeah.
Not bring it down to earth, just to force you to stop and reflect and realign.
Yeah.
So to me, it was basically, who are you kidding? Do you really think you're going to be a muso and playing on the stage or being a busker in the streets or whatever? Or your parents worked, first generation migrated from Greece. I was the first one born in Australia, first one to finish school, first one to go to university. Dad was a taxi driver. Mum worked in a factory from the day she was 16. And, they worked hard. And good Lord, I'm not going to squander that. So I worked hard.
No,
The risk, sorry, I was going to say, the risk for all of us is ensuring that we pass that ethic down to our kids, next generation.
Yes,
And that applies to the lab, that applies to all the people that trained with me, the work ethic. You've made it this far because you're smart, but look around you. So is everybody else. What are you going to do that's different? And what are you going to do that's going to really make a mark?
yeah, and we touched upon this last time when we pre-met for this episode. about differentiation and hard work, but I would like to add something to it. I think when if you absolutely you need to be smart, you need to work hard, but at the same time you need to be doing something that you enjoy, because it's hard doing a job that you're maybe good at but that you hate. You don't want to work hard at that. You want to do something that you enjoy. And what I personally enjoy a lot is doing what we're doing right now.
And I would not have taken the role as dean if I wasn't prepared to take on the, I never wanted to be dean. I was always a researcher for 20 years plus, and then it took 2.5 years for the previous dean, Bill, who happens to be a good friend of mine and has been a mentor. So he twisted my arm a fair bit. And there's two things I want to touch upon because we mentioned it briefly in the, when we pre-met about the differentiation. So I'm going to come to that. But also the thing about the decision to become the, I think I may have mentioned it to you, was that was a that was another crossroads for me. And not only was it 2.5 years in the thinking and the reflecting, but when I was gotten down to the point of it, basically throwing my hat, deciding to throw my hat in the ring, I pretty much, there was a GRC. Where I pretty much surveyed the field. I went to all my colleagues, to Bob, to Brian, to Michelle, to Andrew. I spoke to Fiona Marsh. Actually, Fiona Marsh was on. I shouldn't say that now. Bob and my Fiona referees. I pretty much spoke to all, Laura Bond, Roger Sunahar, everybody, all my friends. And it was almost a 50-50 split of down. Are you insane? Right. So half of them were saying, do it, but do it. For if you if you know, and Michelle was very good, he goes, I've got autonomy and I got a budget. He goes, you can do it. But the other half is saying, what are you doing? And so, but I don't regret it. It's a natural evolution in where I wanted to go to have impact in doing something that I like. And that brings us back to your point. Remember that we discussed the Venn diagram that I showed you, right? So when I first became dean, I put up a Venn diagram that I drew, and it had three circles. One said differentiation, because I'm all about that. If you can't say what differentiates you from something else, then you've got to be able to set the elevator pitch. The other one is impact. So you had three, that's the third one. And the second one, sorry. And the third one is what you said. And I called it interest. And what I meant by that was, do you actually like what you do? Which is exactly what you're saying. So people can say, all right, I'm doing this project. I'm going to get on a Nature paper with 20 other people in a big name lab, whatever. Do I actually like this? And that actually was a decision I had to make early in my postdoc when I realized, no, I don't want to go down that particular path. And so that's a story for later, for now. So those three things, differentiation, impact, and do you like what you do? And the intersection in the middle, I had an arrow that says, you are here. And if you're not here, then my job is to get you there or to move you on in
No,
a nice
I
way.
totally obviously. No, I totally love it. But what I forgot to say when we started recording is that we're gonna be doing two, if not three, little segments out of this discussion. So let's I would like us to focus at this point on up until you became dean, because I think after that, that experience is also absolutely important to capture. And but the other question I had for you, you mentioned, coming to the US, being born in Australia, first generation, and coming to the US for a postdoc. I'm curious to hear more about the decision. How come the US? And also, what was the cultural difference that you've experienced? Because I mean, Australia is far, far away and culturally different.
Well, they're all important issues. The decision was it's relatively straightforward. I got to the point where I wanted to do a postdoc in Nigel Birdsall's lab in Mill Hill in the UK, or Issam's lab. I had visited Issam's lab. They're both looking at it, looking for positions. In the end, though, Minnesota also. My wife is also a pharmacologist, and she. He, her research was on at the time on opioids and endomorphins. In fact, she's the first person to raise the antibodies to endomorphin too, and she did it in Minnesota. So Minnesota had a really big pain research program. So essentially, there were positions for the both of us. So that's what settled the USA, right? So that's why I made the decision. So I was always interested in neuropharmacology. So I was working with Issam and in the psychiatric stuff. Trace was doing opioid work with Martin Wesendorf. There were some great guys, great people. At the time when I was there, Minnesota, I think, was probably pulling the third largest in terms of pulling in funding for pain research. So it was cold, but but I got used to that fairly quickly. And that's actually bottom line. That was a decider. Nigel, I mean, had a position, but Minnesota had a position for both of us. In terms of what the USA, well, that's why. But I didn't. I always thought that, well, I'll probably either end up in the US or the UK. In Australia, traditionally, it had been the thing that you should go overseas to do your postdoc. I still feel that you're doing that, addresses your third point about culture. But now, of course, we have such a vibrant research community in Australia anyway. You don't have to go overseas. For example, Patrick Sexton didn't go overseas to do, but Patrick is exceptional wherever he is, so it doesn't matter. But for me, it was almost expected for most, a lot of us, it was kind of expected you'd go overseas to do a postdoc. And I would recommend to people, if they can, do, because it speaks to number three, which is doing science in a different country. The cultural aspects of it are just as valuable as are the scientific aspects. And the number of people that I met, some of my heroes that I met for the first time by going to the US, I don't think I could have done it if I hadn't gone there. I met them earlier than I thought I would meet. And so they were really inspirational. So because I was in Minnesota, for example, within my first few months there, I met Lee Lindbergh, right? Lee Lindbergh was
She's
on
wonderful.
incredible, right? She's a force of nature. So I put my hand up and said, I want to meet with Lee Lindbergh, and she spent more than an hour with me, and the advice she gave me, still resonates to this day. And I met Paul Insull, I met Rick Neubig, I met Harvey Mitulski. That's actually Harvey Mitulski and I, first met. We've been corresponding ever since I was a PhD student, since GraphPad Prism 1. But this was around the time two had come out, three wasn't out yet, and we met, and we just started working together ever since. So a lot of the stuff that is in Prism is because I put it in there, but I convinced Harvey to put all this pharmacology in there, but I would never have met Harvey or all of those people. And Terry, I had already met. A lot of people might, they know the relationship that Terry and I are good friends. We've done stuff. Terry was one of my heroes when I was doing my PhD. And in 96, I know it's a bit of a long-winded, but it's part of the answer to the whole question. In 96, it was the first time I ever got to go overseas. I was ever on a plane to go overseas. And it was going to my first international conference. And it was a muscarinic receptor conference. And I wanted to visit, I'd read Terry's books, the second edition of his book really changed. It was a game changer for me, right? So other than Fred, Terry really had a influence on me in terms of writing style, what you can do with receptor. That was an aha moment for me, reading his book, right? So I was a huge fan. And back then, they had faxes. So I faxed Terry when he was at Glaxo, it was GSK in North Carolina. I faxed him. And I said, I'm coming over there. I work with Fred Mitchelson. I'm coming to the conference. Can I come and visit you at GSK? And I remember going, I went to see the movie Independence Day with my friend Albert. And then when I come back, it was about a week later when I went to the movie. I came back, and then Tracy's there with a fax, holding in front of me. She said, Terry replied, and I'm looking at it. And he said, if you're coming all the way, yes, if you're coming all the way to see me, the least I can do is buy you lunch.
I
So
love it.
that's how I met Terry in 96. And then obviously once I moved to the States and we connected, and he's been actually come to my place, and we've had him down ever since. But so the cultural aspect, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but I've answered all three, I
No,
think.
you did. No, absolutely did. Do you still have the facts?
No, I don't. I don't. I actually was looking for it the other day. But it's okay. I've got lots of other stuff from Terry. We've written stuff together. We have photos. I've got video. I've got a video of him playing Monopoly with my son when my son was 9, and my son wiped the board with him, which is great. What I do have though, my original, I was showing them to a friend of mine yesterday, because the original lab books that I had when I was a PhD student, when I was deriving a lot of the stuff for my own benefit, that's now in published or GraphPad. I still have all those original things, and they pointed out to me, you better save these, because I've actually, even cubes within cubes within cubes, I just draw them by pen and stuff. So this Yes, yeah, that's that.
Oh.
I just realized I've got a lot of stuff there that I got to make sure doesn't
Yep.
get
It's
lost.
exactly. No, I agree. I agree. I love it. I love it. And it's interesting that, you've been mentioning all of these people and their faces pop up in my head because we've recorded podcast episodes with everyone,
Well, yeah,
including.
it's amazing. You've done an amazing job. I'm looking at all the people that have spoken on the podcast, and I'm calling, thinking, "Holy cow, this is almost a, because the second big thing for me, again, it was in the States, but I got to travel to international, my first big international conference post that, and it was this one will go down in history. I don't know. You can ask Bob or you can ask Michelle. But there was a meeting in 1998. I was a postdoc in Minnesota. The meeting in 1998. And it was in Murano. That's in it was in the Italian Alps, and it was sort of at the border of Switzerland, I think, and Austria. I don't know my geography, but it's right up there. It's like the Sound of Music, right? And it was in a castle, and that was the first time I met a whole bunch of my other heroes. In particular, I got to have a bus ride with Fred Aylett, who was one of my, from the get-go, I was one of my inspirations. And we just, Michelle was in the bus, Bob was in the bus. I mean, wheels on the bus go around. Jeff, Brian was there. Dave Cahoon was at the meeting. Nigel Birtall was at the meeting, and it was all about efficacy. Paul Leff spoke at the meeting. I can't explain. There was some Danny Hoyer, Nigel Shankly. I'm sitting there getting my mind blown, but also it was really, really hot and really, really interesting. And because it was about efficacy, there were a couple of moments where people just wouldn't agree, which is great for me as a young person watching what's happening. And that's where I first, I remember meeting Michel in particular, and he remembers meeting me. And he's always, every time I spoke to him, I always get good advice. But there was one talk, Dave Cahoon was so funny. He got up there, and it was so hot that he was just wearing shorts and a ripped shirt. Because when I originally, I didn't realize it was him until he got up there and talking. Oh my God, that's Dave Cahoon. Nigel introduced us, and it was so hot. He was sweating. He was unbuttoning himself. I don't know. Bob may have told this story, but I know that at some stage Bob turned to Michelle and said, "I predict that by the end of this lecture, that man will be naked." But it was amazing, and I got to meet all these people and talk to them. And you can't. It's international meetings are great, but it's also great if you're based somewhere else and where you're trained in, just to get cultural exposure.
No, I agree. I think leaving the nest that you spent 5, 6, 7 years in a PhD program, depending on where you are, you need to leave. You need to experience something new and changing countries. I think is also very helpful from a personal growth perspective. But one thing I wanted to ask, because you mentioned, faxing, sending a faxitary and sending emails and writing and things like that. I was at the Gordon Conference in Switzerland. And any other conference I've been at, and what I've noticed is the junior scientists, PhD students, postdocs have this fear of going to talk to the senior folks. And it was interesting because this time I was at the GRS and the GRC as well, and we had two days together with the junior scientists of the GRS, so you could feel some kind of a camaraderie also happening. And then when the other generation came in, and the big shots came in, when you think about it, you could sense that the trainees were less comfortable, for example, asking questions and things like that. What would be your advice to a PhD or a postdoc?
Well, put it this way, I still see myself as a trainee. I see myself as one of them. Because when you talk about the big shots coming in, well, they were the big shots even for me when I was coming in as a postdoc and a PhD student. But I went up and spoke to them, and there are different tactics you can use to do so. But the easy one to say to people is this: what scientist doesn't like talking about their work, right? The hardest thing. I guess one of the misconceptions that younger trainees may have when they see the big shots all talking amongst themselves is, okay, they're literally talking amongst themselves, and so you feel like you can't interrupt or whatever. They're not trying to blow you off. You should, because I think we mentioned this in the pre-chat that we had last week about I was asked recently, last year, by an early to mid-career researcher at a conference. She said to me, and I actually mentioned this to, I texted this to Roger because I didn't, the answer just came. She mentioned, she said to me, "Have you ever been starstruck? Right? Have you ever been starstruck?" And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, I've met Nobel laureates, I've actually played the guys in Kiss or whatever, And then, but I have just as much joy in talking to, early career research or PhD students that are passionate about their stuff. So what just blurted out of my mouth was greatness recognizes greatness. And what I meant by that is if you're genuine and good at what you do and care about what you do, you'll naturally want to talk to the other person and they will want to talk to you. So I'm telling any, so I spent, I'll spend as much time talking to a grad student or a trainee as I would to an established field leader. And in many cases, more so because if you're genuine and you get engaged and you're engaging, you do it. And I did it all. There were multiple instances when I was a PhD student, but particularly postdoc, right? Where I guess I had the early experience where I had someone like Lee or someone meet with me and spend time with me. It showed me, well, you can talk to someone at that point. But then what I would recommend to trainees is talk to them. Even take them to your poster, if you have a poster sort of thing. And in fact, one of the tricks that I used to use when I was a postdoc and I didn't realize I was doing it was when I would go to conferences early in the late 90s and early 2000s in particular, when I was redoing the Alice theory stuff, which is not normal. You don't end up back where you started from, but that's actually what's happened to me. And we can talk about that another time. I would purposefully go not just to established names talks, but I would go to every single poster from a drug company or a other lab or whatever that had a hint of LSDism, and I would just spend ages talking to them. And it paid dividends really, because afterwards, there were two things that happened. One is they remembered me and they would either invite me to go give talks once they realized that I'm, oh, I just made connections and collaborations. Pretend you're not a trainee and pretend they're not a big shot. Go.
I love it. No, I always one of the reasons behind the podcast is really to talk to well, I want to talk to everyone in the field. That's one thing. And in the beginning, actually two points I want to make. One, I want to talk to everyone in the field. Two, I want to be able to show the human behind the science and behind the discoveries, because at the end of the day, we're all humans. We're all in this field that we love. So I think finding commonalities and being able to have a conversation with anyone is important. And yes, if you're afraid to go up to someone you admire, just think about them, that the fact that they were in your shoes some years back, and they're just human.
I can recall, and this is no slight on this person because I'm gonna is a really good friend of mine. It's Brian Roth, right? He's amazing, right? Brian is just he's a Zen master. But I remember the first time I met Brian. It was one of those moments. It was at a conference, and it was around 2003, 2004, or around there, 2002 maybe. And I was just walking on and I saw Brian Roth and I knew his work and I go, this man is phenomenal. And I could just feel that for whatever reason, some people would be scared to maybe go up to Brian. I don't know if that still remains the case, but I went up to him and started talking to him. And then straight away, he just, he's a font of knowledge. And he was just so nice and so sharing. And then I realized that we create an aura around certain people that we perceive as not being approachable, and that is not the case. Well, 99.9% of the time, that's not the case. But I do remember that moment because I was like, I'm gonna go and ask Brian Roth a question. And then he's been giving, he's given me career advice ever since. He's been another pivotal figure in my progression. One of the people that says, stick to what you're doing, kid. You're onto something. Terry was one of them. Rick was one of them. Lee was one of them. So was Brian in those early days.
Phenomenal. Let's go back to science. How did you get into studying GPCRs?
Well, that's simple because of my PhD project. So in second year of my pharmacology, my favorite lecturer was Fred Mitchelson. He was a lecturer. He was one of those guys. He's an old school classic scholar, an old school academic. He would come in and he would do all the lectures on the brain and neuropharmacology. And he'll be one of those guys that wouldn't be showing you what's in the textbooks. He'd be showing you what isn't, what just got published today, and he'd get the chalk in them and he would talk about it. So in a sense, a lot of people were, thinking of Fred overteaches, and I was thinking, no, I'm absorbing this stuff and it's really resonating with me. So I asked, if I could do a PhD with him, and because I was interested in neuropsychopharmacology. Because the other thing I should have mentioned is at around the same time that I decided to be a pharmacist, and when I started studying, I also decided I want to focus on neuropsychiatrists, particularly schizophrenia. I lost in the band days, I lost one of my friends with schizophrenia. So everyone has a, well, first of all, most people, I wanted to know how things work, right? But second, there was another trigger, which was I'm interested in neuropsychopharmacology, but obviously I branched out because of Alistair. So that's why. And the project that Fred gave me was at the time, it was an M2-ish muscarinic receptor selective antagonist and how it works in the brain. And the theory being, can we look at presynaptic M2 receptors and control acetylcholine release in as a means for maybe drugs for Alzheimer's? Because, sorry, to boost acetylcholine release, obviously, if you block the presynaptic receptors. And that's so obviously, he was studying, he was a muscarinic receptor guru. That's how I got into GPCRs. It was the muscarinic receptor, but it's also how I got into Alice theory because it turns out that the compound that he gave me, we found late, we showed later, was not an anti selective antagonist, but it was a NAM, negative allosteric modulator. So I got tricked into Alice theory.
And
So
where did that
muscarinic receptor.
compound muscarinic well, yeah where
Yeah,
did that
muscarinic.
compound sorry what's the delay
Sorry,
what's the story
exactly.
behind the compound
Do you want that on this podcast or do you want that on the next podcast? This
we
comp
could
this compound is part of the history of Alice theory, and people don't know that. This compound dates back to 1969, 1968.
wow.
In a nutshell, I'll tell you the story in another podcast, but in a nutshell, basically, this was one of in the early 70s, Fred did a sabbatical in Germany, the University of Kiel, in the lab of Heinz Luhlmann. A lot of seminal work was done there. And they were looking at a bunch of nicotinic receptor compounds that they modified and they became antimuscarinics. Fred brought a bunch of those back with him. It turned out they were allosteric modulators. And we can talk about that story in more detail later because it's a fantastic, phenomenal story. So you look, so GPCR allostery goes back to the 60s. And don't forget, in 63 is when they named, well, 62 actually was the term was coined. 63 was the first paper with Changzhang and such. But there were papers from in 68 and 69 that actually had allosteric modulators that people didn't know were allosteric modulators, and
Wow.
probably even earlier.
That's really cool. Did he bring the compounds back in his
Yes.
briefcase or
I
how? No, the reason I'm asking this because even please go ahead.
I don't know. Fred's the other thing I want to say about Fred, because we can leave the rest for another podcast. Fred published one of these seminal papers on Alice theory in 1976. Fred, it was in the British Journal of Pharmacology, and Fred was the guy that using organ bath techniques, which I also learned. I learned binding and organ bath work, tissue bath. In 1976, it was the compound galamine. The galamine was used as a, as an in surgery and such as an anti-nicotinic agent, but it has M2 off-target M2 muscarinic receptor side effects. And Fred showed that the mechanism behind galamine's M2 effects was, negative allosteric modulation, essentially. That a lot of people forget that, but a lot of people accept that galamine was one of the first modulators published, and people, especially the muscarinic field. But Fred's struggled so much to get that paper published because no one believed him. And then in 82, Nigel Bertzel and Ed Hulme and the team, they did the binding studies to prove that galamine was allosteric, and that was published in Moelle Farm. So Fred was doing it from the 70s, and that's the guy I trained with.
Wow. The reason I was asking about the briefcase and how the actual compound, just because it was a different time. And obviously, well, I did my PhD a couple of years later. And then whenever we were to send DNA to one lab to another, and if you were traveling, you just took the tube with you. You can't do that, obviously, today.
No, you can't. People still st stick stuff in the mail, as you know, but I'm not going to talk about that because we don't do that. I don't know if Fred brought it back, although I suspect it was pretty much along those lines. That would have been in envelopes, and it would have been in a, because I remember when I was doing some experiments in the lab with Fred, we were using some pretty serious anticholinesterases. to as well, almost mustard gas level stuff. And it was pretty much just, don't breathe this in, wear gloves, throw it down the sink or something like it. It's just, I look back now and I'm horrified. And it was like, that's really one another story for the trainees. I was remember weighing out on the weighing scales. I'm just weighing out some atropine, right, on the weighing tray. And then I did the stupid once I before I cleaned it up, I did the stupid thing that came as a reflex. I just blew on the up there to blow away the dust. You can imagine what happened, right? About an hour or so later, I'm in the office and I'm struggling to focus on my computer. And I turned to my friend and I said, is this something wrong with the screen? And he looked at me and he goes, oh my God. He goes, what? He goes, well, one of your eyes is brown and the other one is black because I got atropine in my eye
Oh
and I
my
had
God.
big rashes. Right? So what, that's dumb. And this is the thing about the old days. So Fred said to me, you idiot. And then he went to the freezer and got some methotrexate eye drops, which we were using for lab classes. And that was sealed. But he just gave them to me, goes, put those in your eye and you should be fine by tonight. And that's what happened. But imagine that these days, just that happening. And then someone giving you eye drops from the lab, the practice, and go, put that in your eye. And I'm just lucky it wasn't a long lasting antagonist like Q&B
Yeah.
or whatever. I'd be walking around in sunglasses for days.
No, it was definitely a different time. Now it would be completely different. But then again, well, different times, different. We've evolved a lot. So I have in these questions with me a question about your favorite GPCR, and we kind of talked about it before we hit record, but I'm curious.
Well, okay, so
And why?
because of my interest in neuropsychiatry, in particular cognition, I've always felt the muscarinic receptors, especially M1, well, more so M4, have had always untapped potential. And now history is proving us right. So M4 is my favorite receptor. And now you're seeing compounds. In fact, my postdoc in the States was on a compound called xanomeline, which was Eli Lilly's compound, failed. Crashed out of Alzheimer's trials. They said M1, M4 preferring agonist, orthosteric, but we just published a paper showing they bind both sides. So I did my early work on xanomeline, and now it's being repurposed with a peripherally restricted anticholinergic called trospium, and it's called KarXT, and it's been gone through phase three trials in schizophrenia, and it's likely to get FDA approved this year. It's Karuna, which was the guys that I worked with at Lilly, most of them. Karuna Therapeutics. So you're going to see possibly the first in-class new antipsychotic in over 50 years, and it's targeting muscarinic receptors. And then we've got the M4 PAMs, Cerevel, which were ex-Pfizer, spun out. Everyone gets rid of psychiatry. Everyone gets rid of something just before it's about. Now I was telling them, no, keep it, right? They spun out a company called Cerevel. They've got an M4 PAM, which has gone through phase one. So Karuna just got bought out by
So.
BMS, and Cerevel just got bought out by AbbVie because of the M4 PAM potential for psychosis. And I've seen better compounds. And I was saying this 10 something years ago, M4 PAMs, psychosis. That's always been my favorite receptor. And it's linked to the diseases that I'm interested in. And it's more around cognitive deficits because you know what's going to happen next. If these things work, they're going to start testing them for other cognitive disorders as well.
Of course they
Yeah.
will.
Right.
Of course they will,
Yeah.
because you've
Now,
passed so many other hurdles.
Yeah. I'll cheat a little bit and add one more receptor to the list. And that's the A1 adenosine receptor. Because that's another one that we've done a lot of work on. And I'm particularly interested in as a potential target for treating neuropathic pain. And also, so we published a paper, we showed PAMs working in that state. So that's disease-specific pharmacology. We solved the structures. We're the first ones to solve the structures. And we're also looking at potential biased agonists and cardiovascular events for heart failure. And so I've been doing a lot of early work on the A1 as well. And we can leave the reason why to another podcast why. Yeah, for calisthenics, I just went from receptor to receptor to receptor. So I would say M4 and probably A1.
Love it.
And
I
serine
want.
22, serine 228 for Andrew Tobin.
I will make sure that we send him a link to this podcast when it airs.
Yeah.
You mentioned, after your postdoc coming back to Australia, and then getting together with Roger and Patrick, well, after when you ended up at Monash, I really want to hear more about the idea. When did that idea come from to join forces, and how do you think it benefited not only the field but also the trainees?
I'll answer the first bit, then I'm going to answer the third bit, then I go to the second bit. So I'm going to go
Perfect.
how about the trainees in the field. So when I got back to Melbourne Uni, it was a classical pharmacology department when they still existed, whatever. So most people labs operate in silos. So I was a GPCR guy, Patrick was a GPCR guy, and at the time in Australia, there was people doing GPCR research, but they weren't necessarily doing GPCR research in the sense that I'm doing a neuropeptide here, I'm focusing on something else in the heart there, but it happens to be targeting it. And Patrick and I both realized very quickly that we have complementary skills and interests in GPCRs. I had the analytical pharmacology background. He had a lot of protein chemistry, biochem, molecular biology experience, and we got along like a house on fire. And we basically said, let's do something that hasn't done before. Why just have just lab and a lab? Why don't we, if we combine our resources into one pot and just said one lab, two heads, it's like if I had half a postdoc and you had half a postdoc salary, together we have a postdoc. And we just did that and we just tried it. It was a risk. It had been done at the time. And all of a sudden the group grew and we were able to train more people, but in a manner that hadn't been done before, because they get exposed to different skill sets and everyone gets it's more cross-fertilization. And it just grew and grew and grew. And then we did the exact same thing when Roger had gone to Monash. We went to Monash. We said to Roger, let three heads, one lab. And then it becomes like a super lab where we all, and then people get to see lots more different types of science. They get leadership experience as well in terms of different responsibilities. Collectively, we could do more, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that model, really, really took off. And then when we moved to Monash, actually it's before we moved to Monash, we really started doing this, because now the field bit, because Australia is a great place, but it's far away from everywhere, right? And it was around 2002 when we were all working like this, and we said, first of all, the other thing that this model did is it actually started building a critical mass of GPCR researchers in Australia. Many of whom have since gone on and started their own groups, and even wherever they can try to replicate the model. That's one consequence. But the other thing we did was, let's use our resources just to bring the field to us. And so we started a series of conferences, our own conferences in molecular pharmacology of GPCR conferences in 2002. It was me, Patrick, and Roger. And we just used whatever money we had stashed away to bring people down, like Michelle, came down, Graham Milligan, we've had everybody. And since then, these things have become almost like as good as a GRC or a Keystone in terms of the quality of the speakers and the reputation wise. But that was a huge risk, because you got to take a risk. So we said, since we can't, everyone in the lab go here, there, and everywhere to see, what I experienced when I was overseas, let's bring the field to us. And those have been going ever since. And now they've been taken over by the next gen. So that's also started with that model and that mindset of take the risk. Just like you tell a trainee, go talk to the big. We were like, well, who says we can't start our own conference if you've got some money left aside? Who says we can't go out and talk to sponsors and raise money? Because we knew GPCRs are big, and we knew only going to get bigger. So we were able to get corporate sponsorship from people that whatever, but we raised all the money. That was the risk. It's now it's paid off.
I love it. Yeah, and I think it's some the way you were talking about this was exactly the way I think about all the activities that we do at Dr. GPCR. And even with the podcast, when I started out, I think I told you this when we first connected, I sent out 20 emails. I think 15 people I knew, five I knew of, or we kind of knew each other, and I asked, what do you think? Do you think it would make sense? And there I had 75% say, sure, I'm happy to come on the podcast. Let's do this. And then people were wondering why we're doing what we're doing. And I think it's one, it's about bringing the field together. One of the comments I got is that I identified the missing pieces, a missing thread in the field. We're all in our little labs, we're all doing science, and then we get together once a year or two, twice a year, and then COVID hit, and then That changed it
Yes.
all.
Yeah.
But being able to every day be connected to your fellow GPCR scientist and be able to see what's been done, but also being able to message someone and say, "Hey, I'm working on this. Do you want to collaborate?" Or, the story that's stuck in my head is someone goes to the lab to a lab, works a year and a half on a project, and then another postdoc walks by and says, "Well, three other postdocs tried this and it doesn't work."
Yep. So
And
what you're enunciating is, in my view, another example of breaking down silos between people, right? So we reflect on the model that we built and the way we run the lab, and even now how we are structured. And we're at my faculty, my institute. We don't, as I said, we got rid of departments. We have themes, and teaching is determined at the. Oh, that's okay. It's more of a dean thing, maybe, but we've been used to it for a long time. Not doing things the typical way, particularly in terms of fostering multidisciplinarity in what you do, and what you're doing, what you're describing is your version of that, which is fantastic. That's the only way to go. So how else are you going to be different? How else are you not going to be incremental, right? How else are you going to not make the same mistake over and over and over again? That's if someone could just save you the grief and or give you an idea or an opportunity to go in a different direction and get it right.
at the time when this model, when you came, when you all three of you or two and three of you then came up with this model, did you face any resistance from the university? Or just I'm asking this because it's such a unique model. I love it. I think it's great, but I wonder if there was at the time some.
Well, it's yes and no, because but yes, in the sense that the kind of model, well, no, the model, the university itself didn't have a particular issue I could recall with the model, but there was a simple thing we wanted to do was just to co bring a couple of our labs, just relocate some of the labs to be closer to one another. And that was where the university or particular department had an issue with, it's actually why Patrick left first. He left to go to the Howard Florey Institute because of politics that had nothing to do with us, where we're sitting there saying, no, if you bring these groups together and you do things this way, you can have a program grant, you can do this, you can do that. But there was a mindset, a silo mindset that, this is the traditional department structure. No. Post that, and especially when we were recruited by Monash, it was one of the conditions, right? And now it's like, yes, are you crazy? Because even if you're a department, even I say that now, even if you're a department head or a school head or a dean or whatever, or a researcher, individual lab, what are you known for? What do you different? Can you say what different? We said this at the start, right? So restructuring along this way is a point of differentiation. Otherwise, you can look at a university, or you can look at whether it's Harvard, Stanford, or Monash or whatever. People say, I want to train with Brian Kobilka. They don't say, I want to train as a postdoc at Stanford and for someone, but they get, well, or I want to go to MIPS now because MIPS is known for translational GPCR pharmacology from bench to onwards sort of thing, so
No,
yes.
I think that's really interesting, and I think it's all about, well, first of all, having the science and having the accomplishments. Second, making the case that it's beneficial for everyone.
There are a number. That's just one of many inflection points that I can at least see in my career, things that we've done different. And I do recall, I remember Bob, when Bob had visited Australia, and we were having dinner at my place, and he was there with Lee, and he pointed out, he goes, I don't know how Bob does this. I have no idea. He's on top of everything. He said, I've been following you and Patrick are now the third longest lasting collaboration in the field since so and so and so and
Wow.
so. I'm like, oh, where did this statistic come from? Goldstein and that and everything. So Patrick and I are apparently number three at the time on Bob's list of longest collaborators. So we're going 25 years now, nearly 20, nearly.
Did he mention who was number one and number two on that list, if you remember?
I actually forgot, to be honest. He did, but I forgot. I think it was Bernard Goldstein. No, I can't remember. I'm trying to remember. There was a couple. Whether that
That
was still last.
That's Bob.
Yeah.
I'm not
Yeah.
surprised. This is typical. Definitely.
I mean, I can't remember the rest because I was just, I remember just being so shocked because my mind's going, how does he know this? And now, of course, we're collaborating together on stuff. So, yeah, full circle.
Yeah, love it. I love it. From a science perspective, when you merged your labs, and you mentioned, and I know this, that you all have complementary skills, but what does it look like when a postdoc joins your lab? Do you give them a project, or do they get to come up with their project? And what is the support they get?
Okay, so I have to step back a bit now because obviously I've been dean for the last 5 years. So the way my lab operates, obviously, is I have, for example, now Céline Vallon, who joined my lab in 2006 as a postdoc and has been there ever since. Dave Thal joined me a few years ago and he's still there. So Céline and David, basically, they run the lab now. So but again, we run that as a collective. So Patrick and Denise Wooten, you know, they've got their collective, and even that we collaborate. But I've got my new minister. So there's like mini versions of what we did have budded off, you know, and you have mini natural groups, whatever. So our group is myself, Celine, and David. And so if they're joining my lab, they're joining us to look at essentially, you know, we were focusing on neuropsychiatry. It depends on what target and disease we're doing at the time, but it's mostly now neuropsychopharmacology more than anything else, whether it's and so they write and well if we have grants, if we have funding, we advertise. It's as simple as that. But we also have people that have written to us, and if they bring their own fellowships or scholarships, we can support them. But the rest is timing, really. The trick that I do, all right, I'll tell you because you're about the project bit. There is a general project that I'm wanting to put this person on because, for example, if I need a chemist or if I need a behavioral pharmacologist, whatever, I know that I need that particular type of skill set. So that I know. But it's more important to them that, you know, you need to know this better than me. If I'm hiring a chemist or a behavioral person, you've got to know this better than me, right? But I just know I need it. And that's also a story for the allosteric, and that's how I built the lab and went, you know, I decided what I needed, when I needed it, how. So what I do sometimes is, I don't do it as much now because I've got the other job, but I used to bring them in and say, okay, this is how essentially helping design the project. So I know what the project is essentially, but I know I want it, you know, to have the impact, whatever. I need their help. So I asked them to tell me what's really, really exciting. I've done this a few times. What's really like, you know, what's going to knock your people's socks off? What do you really want to do in this space? Every now and then I would lie. I'd say, I've got $1 million, but I have to spend it by the end of the year, right? And it's like, we've got to spend it by the end of the year. So what do you do? And then more often than not, what I get back is an iteration of what I hired them to do in the first place. And then I say, no, take your time. You're the expert. Go, you know, you go away, read, come back in a couple of weeks, and until we've got all this money. What do you do? And then they might come back and say, okay, we want to do optogenetics here. We want to generate this mouse there. We want to do da da da. And I said, wow, that's fantastic. I go, now, I don't have $1 million. I don't have that money, but that's a great idea, right? So that's so much more impactful than what we were originally discussing. But, you know, we can collaborate with this person to do that and that person to do that. And I can give you X amount of money to generate a mouse and boom, you know, or variants thereof. You know, I just sort of tell. I do what it takes to get people to think, start at the finish line, work backwards, you know, what does success look like? Imagine the money is no object. So many scientists and academics and they're just the first thing I think about is money, the money, and therefore what can I slice and dice with the money? I'm saying don't think about money at all. Just assume you've got some philanthropist just gave you $100 million. What are you going to do? And then work that way and then work backwards.
I love
Then
it.
you'll,
I love it
yeah.
because you have the end of the. It's like a script. It's like a movie script. What's the ending?
Yeah, and the proof is in the pudding. If you look at our institute, I mean, we just, you know, under Bill, and now the next thing, me, it's proven that it's not just the person, it's the culture, you know, that was engendered in the place thinking like this. The Bill thought like that, you know, I think like that. So, and most of the people, we can't afford not to. We are 1/8 of the size of the medical faculty, but we account for about 50% nearly of all therapeutic commercialization that's coming out of Monash University. Now, therapeutic, not all commercialization. So, we hit above our weight, but you can't afford to do that without a culture where everyone's open and sharing, and it's translational. It's translational. I don't have a single project that does not involve other themes within my institute and outside in terms of chemistry, formulation sciences, behavior. I don't put a single thing in an animal now unless we do our own, PK analyses like you would in pharma, right? Okay, so we've got the capability, but you got to do it. Otherwise, you might as well be putting dust into a mouse. So that's what we do. But we built that up.
Wow, I love it. I kind of knew some of these bits and pieces, but I'm very impressed, and I think it's a very unique, not only model, but a unique way of thinking about it. I don't think I've ever spoken to anyone who has, this the who has not only the capacity but also has built out exactly this entire infrastructure.
And I mean, obviously, Craig. If you look at Craig Lindsley's operation at Vanderbilt, so they got a really impressive operation. It's sort of structured, but that's heavily chemistry focused, and the DMPK bits, they did that even better than us. But we've got on top of that is we've got the structural biology, we've got the pharmacology, translation pharmacology, we've got medicine use and safety, we've got all the formulation stuff. But it's there are very few institutes that are it's. And that's a center, actually. That's not part of it. We're a whole faculty that are like that. And we're the only academic institution in the country that's structured like a drug company outside of pharma, but we don't work, that way. So that is really it is interesting. And going back to things like mentors and advice, again, Michel Bouvier, I'm going to mention Michel because there was a time, maybe 10 years ago or so, I was being headhunted for something else to be part of his really big center, and it was very, very tempting. And but we were establishing the model that we just described now at MIPS as well. So I actually had a, it was actually I remember exactly where it was. It was in Copenhagen in 2010. We sat down, I had a beer with Michel, and I asked him about this because it was only one of those career junctures. And he said to me basically, "Do you want to be part of a well-oiled machine?" He goes, "Or do you want to build something new from scratch, which is what you're doing?" And then I like, right. So I stayed, and the rest is history.
I love it. Top three aha moments that
I don't know. I think
I think all the inflection points
I
could
gave them
be
to. I yeah,
yeah.
yeah. I think I've given them to you earlier. Earlier, I'd say I remember mentioning at least one aha moment. Terry's the big one was the first one really was Terry as a PhD student reading Terry Kanakin's book. The 1994 edition, because if you look at my first two papers, the first paper was published in European Journal of Pharmacology in 93, second was published in 94 in Moll Pharm. Look at the difference between the two papers, it's the same compound. And the second one had the appendix, my first ever appendix with equations and everything. I discovered Terry's book and I read it from cover to cover. That was the first time ever I read anything like that. And after I read that, I said, that wasn't a ha. That was like, oh, this is what you can do with receptor theory and receptor pharmacology. And then I went and got every single paper at the end of this chapter. So that was definitely an aha moment because that failing was one, this was the other one. Because before that, I was my supervisor even had to sit me down and give me the talk early on, which is, look, you're good, but you're sort of wandering. Do you really want to do this, or do you want to write up as a master's and move on? And after I read Terry's book, I became obsessed with receptors and what you can do. And all of a sudden, just boom, the rocket just took off, right? So that's another one. And then I said, the third one. There are so many. I don't know whether it's I guess the third one would be, and I want to say it in a way it doesn't sound conceited or whatever. So it's actually not a hard moment. No, sorry, it's not a hard moment. I was going to say, I'm proud that we've done a lot of work to put basically what I call analytical pharmacology back on the map. We've brought that sort of pharmacology to the masses. And it's not just me, that's the people that I trained. And seeing, so if there was an aha in that, is watching the field do things like they're all using the operational model. Everyone's heard of that now, right? They're doing shield analysis and stuff like that. I put all that stuff in prison in the early days, right? But now every people have taken Jim Black would be laughing his head off seeing the operational model in prison, because that, so I'm glad that's I'm just delighted that so many people are using bringing in classical pharmacology as a tool, as well as a discipline, into what they do in a multidisciplinary project. I think, yeah. And the best thing out of that's come out of that are the people that we've trained.
Love it. All right. Before we stop recording this tidbit, you mentioned PRISM, and I was wondering if you can tell us the story. How did you end up
Okay. With Harvard,
collaborating?
I clearly no shares, no money. Oh man, did I make a mistake? I did. Okay.
No, I mean to be, and I know that it was it, the collaboration came out of a place where there was this tool, at least based on what we've talked about last time, there was this tool, and you couldn't use the tool to actually do the work that you were interested in.
Exactly. So the beauty of GrabPad was its simplicity. Harvey was very, clever in design. He came up, it was from his early work as doing stuff at UCSD when he was working with Paul Insall. That was before prison. Version one. So I was a PhD student. Someone came back with a floppy disk with version one of Prism. At the time, I was using SigmaPlot. I was using EbdaLigan. I was using Origin. I was using Excel. I was trying to do everything under the sun to analyze things, especially. And then, I saw version one of Prism and it just generated such easy things like that. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And then I wrote to Harvey about some minor aspects, more color options or more curve fitting with this, like the other. I emailed him, he replied, and I was stunned. And then we just stayed in contact. So when I started my postdoc in the States, that's when I met Harvey, that's when we really got talking about stuff. I got a pre-release version of Prism 3, which was the first version that allowed you to do Monte Carlo simulations. So I just did a whole bunch of those and I got a paper out of it. It was, but that also was when we were thinking about how 3 will go to 4, that we sat down. I mean, like I flew to his place. We spent a whole week together. We wrote a lot of stuff together and we shared. That's where a lot of all the pharmacology really got into it. Global fitting came into version 4 because I was, talking to Harvey about you want to share parameters across data sets. You want to reduce receptor. I remember Harvey thinking at the time, why would people care about reducing receptor numbers? And I said, believe me, they do, they will. Because don't forget, the 1980s was the era of binding. It was binding and grinding, they called it. I trained on binding and organ bath, tissue-based work, and I know. It's all going to come back to the tissue and the animal. So you want it. So global fitting, operational models, shield analysis, EC50 analysis, allosteric ternary complex model, all of that I put into version 4 with, and Harvey's so receptive to now he's retired, but they were always receptive to anyone telling them this would help the field. And that's why the truth is in 08, they offered me a position to take over as president if Harvey was going to step down. And I thought about it, and probably should have said yes, but I said, no, I'm better where I am because I can tell you what people want to see in the program. So that's how it came about. We've been good friends. By the way, his birthday is April 11th, as is mine. We share a birthday. But yeah, that's how it came about. And I'm just proud that I was able to contribute to something. And it's and yeah, to this day continues to grow.
I
A
just
lot of people.
updated my I just updated my Prism today, and I was happy with the new color schemes because I was plotting some data. Like, oh, okay, now actually it looks it
Yeah, but
got
that's
even
fun.
better.
Look, it's still right. They've been bought out now by a very big group, but you can still write to Harvey, and I did, about something, and they respond. So, but I'm really proud of that collaboration. For me, version 4 was a game changer, and that's me and Harvey. That's what all the stuff that most people now take for granted in prison. That's sort of how it happened. But it, and then once it started being taken up by pharma, it just blew up. I should have. But I got nothing. Just to be clear, no money, no nothing. I just did it out of the love. All right.
Well, actually, I do have a couple of notes to share about Prism in general and about presentability. So maybe this is a good
Yeah, no problem.
opportunity.
Yeah, or whenever you want, you can just flick them across. I know. Other so the thing is that this is an important historical note to end off. Other people global fitting, sharing parameters across data sets. If you look, the classic paper, Andre de Leon, right? The classic ternary complex model paper, that's how they had to fit that data. All right, people, Jim Wells, but people writing their own programs, doing their own thing. It was even Munson and Rodbard was using Ligand, the program too. They were available, but they had to be programmed themselves, I guess. At the time, they were needing a lot of computer crunching power, supercomputing back in the days. There's another guy called Doug Ward. If you look back in the 70s, he was doing a lot of this stuff, but they were using supercomputers. Prism now on a little laptop with can do a lot of that stuff, but someone also had to convince and show them the utility of doing that sort of stuff.
Exactly. All right, so I think we should end on this note. To people who will be listening to this recording, we're doing this all in one shot on a Friday night or Saturday morning, depending on who's where. All right, Arthur, thank you so much. This was amazing.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Can I ask you a favor? Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Many of you come back to watch our videos but aren't subscribed. Having more subscribers will help us get you more content. Also, mark your calendars and join me and your GPCR colleagues for the inaugural Endocrine Metabolic GPCRs conference taking place in the UK on April 22nd and 23rd. You'll be able to find more details about the event on the Dr. GPCR ecosystem under the events page. Thank you for joining us and listening to this Dr. GPCR podcast episode. We would like to thank our guests, our Dr. GPCR team, Attila, Ines, Montserrat, Ivana, Andreina, and Balint. If you like our podcast, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can also leave us a testimonial at drgpcr.com and subscribe today to our monthly newsletter. If you're part of the ecosystem, which we encourage you to do, it's free to join us. You'll be getting a weekly email about GPCR news. If you want to know what are the latest papers that were published, what are the latest accomplishments of your colleagues? What are the industry news in the GPCR field? And what are the job opportunities in the GPCR field? Please do join us in the ecosystem. Another great way to support us is to share your favorite program with your network and colleagues. With any questions or suggestions, please email us at hello@drgpcr.com. Until next time, stay safe.